Cannot allow yourself to be seen. You must make certain that you are taken for granted. Disguised in the profane, camouflaged in the routine, in those same realms from which you can attack without warning when necessary. A tall, muscular young man attired in black robes, Ranhar had thick black hair pulled into a bun behind, and with long strands in front dangling from temples to chin. In him, Palpatine could see Vidar, whose body was lying in state, supine on a massive, rectangular stone bier. A simple blanket covered the corpse from shoulders to knees, and on the chest sat a shallow, metallic bowl containing purple flowers and a lighted candle meant to symbolize the Livid Tower's eternal flame. Janus Grigatus would transport the cremation ashes to Naboo, where they would be scattered in the Soliu River.
"Jedi Ranhar Kim," Palpatine said as he entered the room. "Please forgive the intrusion, but I wanted to offer my condolences in person."
Roused from his thoughts, Ranhar whirled on him, almost in defense, and scanned him from head to toe.
"Who are you?" "Palpatine," he said. "I've been appointed to succeed Vidar Kim as Senator of Naboo. I knew your father well."
Ranhar's vigilance eased. "Forgive me for not knowing more about Naboo, Senator Palpatine. But in fact, until several weeks ago, I wasn't aware that Vidar Kim was my biological father, or even that Naboo was my homeworld." Palpatine feigned understanding.
"No need to apologize. I imagine that the Force is, in some sense, its own domain."
Ranhar nodded. "I scarcely knew the man. Were it not for the fact that he was a Republic senator, the Jedi Council would not have granted dispensation for me to meet with him."
Palpatine allowed himself to stretch out with the Force, but only for a moment, and chiefly to gauge the Jedi's reaction, which proved to be indiscernible.
"Excuse me for asking, but why then did you choose to attend the service?"
Ranhar grew pensive.
"No doubt you know about the tragedy that claimed the lives of his wife and sons."
"I do."
"Vidar Kim contacted me to ask if I would consider renouncing my pledge to the Jedi in order to become the bearer of the family name."
Palpatine moved closer to him and added compassion to his voice.
"He told me, Ranhar. Does your presence here reflect doubt as to your obligations?"
"No," the Jedi said, perhaps more firmly than he intended.
"I'm only here out of respect for the man. As you may also know, he died at the hands of an assassin while in my company."
Ranhar's voice betrayed disappointment rather than anger.
"If I had acted sooner, he would be alive. And at present, I can't be certain that the assassin's blaster bolts weren't meant for me rather than Vidar Kim."
"Who in their right mind would target a Jedi Knight?"
The Jedi sniffed and narrowed his dark eyes.
"The Jedi do not lack for enemies, Senator. Doling out justice and ensuring the peace doesn't sit well with some beings."
"The world of politics is no safer, Ranhar. Not in this era, with so many in need. Thank the Force we have the Jedi."
"I wonder," Kim said.
Palpatine regarded him with interest. The Jedi was less interested in solving the murder of Vidar than he was in agonizing over his failure to prevent it.
"You wonder about what, Ranhar?"
"What my life might have been had I not become a Jedi."
Palpatine adopted a look of shock.
"The choice was not yours to make. You have the Force. Your destiny was a foregone conclusion."
Ranhar mulled it over.
"And if Vidar Kim had elected not to surrender me to the Order?" "A line of thought impossible to follow to any conclusion," Palpatine said.
The Jedi looked at him and squared his shoulders.
"There are many forks in the path, Senator. Had I remained on Naboo, I might have followed in Vidar Kim's footsteps and entered politics. Perhaps it's not too late."
Palpatine showed him a tolerant smile and came alongside him, confident now that his true nature was beyond detection.
"I have to admit that the notion of a politician with Jedi values is not without its appeal. In fact, the Republic was once overseen by Jedi Chancellors only. But I'm afraid you're something of an anachronism, Ranha. The galaxy appears to have rejected the idea of enlightened leadership. The best politician presently is merely exceptional, where every Jedi is extraordinary.
Ranha laughed shortly.
More and more, Senator Palpatine. You begin to sound like my former master. Would that I had such talents, Palpatine said, making light of it. But I do have a proposition, Ranha. Not only am I new to the Senate, I'm new to Coruscant, and it would be good to have someone to count on as a friend. So what would you say to an alliance between a politician and a Jedi? Through me, you could gain insight into the workings of the Republic, and through you, I might better understand the Jedi in their roles as peacekeepers.
Ranhard inclined his head in a bow.
I respect Vida Kim all the more for bringing us together.
May the Force be with you, Senator Palpatine.
On Sereno, remote from the core along the Hydean Way, a female servant of Count Vimek, costumed in garb from an era long past, escorted the quartet of human Jedi into the castle's expensively modernized conference room. First to be introduced to those assembled, including dignitaries and politicians representing Sereno and nearby Salonan and the Mune Corps of Damask Holdings, was Jedi Master and Council Member Jocasta New, a pleasant-looking woman with straight hair, pronounced cheekbones, and brilliant blue eyes. Accompanying her were distinguished Jedi Masters Dooku and Sifo Dyas, and a tall, powerfully built Jedi Knight named Qui-Gon Jinn, who remained standing while the rest took their designated seats at the circular table. The three men carried themselves with palpable self-assurance and affected beards of different styles. Dooku's terminated in a stylish point, Sifo Dyas's followed his strong jawline, Qui-Gon's was long and thick. Plagueis, who rarely missed an opportunity to interact with Jedi, had planned to leave the business on Sereno to Larsh Hill and the others, until learning that Dooku would be present. 50 or so standard years old, Dooku was Sereno's native son, hailing from a noble lineage analogous to the Naboo Palpatines. Had he not been born strong in the Force, he would have been a count, in the same way that Palpatine would have been a royal. But on the few occasions Plagueis had encountered Dooku, he had sensed something in him that warranted further investigation. Dooku was said to be one of the Order's finest lightsaber masters, and he had earned a reputation as a skilled diplomat as well. But his passion and restlessness were what had captured Plagueis's attention. For all his decades in the Order, he seemed to have kept one foot anchored in the mundane. In place of the homespun brown robes worn by most Jedi, like the hail Qui-Gon Jinn, Dooku favored cloaks and robes more appropriate to a night at the opera on Coruscant. In addition, he was a candid critic of Supreme Chancellor Darris and the corrupt practices of the Senate. Most important, perhaps, Dooku was linked to the Sith's grand plan in ways that went beyond circumstantial. Some 20 years earlier, in a scheme engineered by Tenebris to replace human Senator Blix Anon with a young upstart named Eero Iridian, Dooku and his then Padawan Qui-Gon Jinn were caught up in the events and had managed to send some of the principal players to prison. Dooku had also unwittingly sabotaged several of Tenebris's plans to foster intersystem dissent in the expansion region. In the aftermath of the near-disastrous assassination of Vidar Kim, Plagueis's interest in Dooku had assumed a new urgency. He felt certain that Sidious would evolve into a commanding Sith, but just now the young Naboo was drunk with power and prone to make mistakes. When the dark recognized one as a true ally, a novice could lose his or her way, as had almost happened to Plagueis following the murder of Carid Sanfe. Bane-adoring Sith masters like Tenebris might have used the meeting on Sereno as a means of threatening their apprentices with replacement.
Plagueis, however, had no such intention, which was why he hadn't mentioned to Sidious that Jedi would be attending the meeting. Even so, he found himself wondering whether a dissatisfied Jedi like Dooku could be insurance against a reversal of fortune, some unexpected event that would rob him of Sidious, or perhaps turn to the dark without formal enlistment and manipulated into instigating a schism in the Order. As he had told Sidious, even a trained Jedi could succumb to the lure of the dark side on his or her own. 130 years earlier, on a former Sith world in the Kalaran system, a Padawan named Kibijin had been so strongly affected by the lingering power in a fortress on Almas that he submitted himself to the dark side and initiated a system-wide conflict. Perhaps under Plagueis' influence, Master Dooku could be inspired to do something similar. The Jedi would bear closer observation. One of Selenon's legal advocates was the first to speak when everyone had been seated.
"Selenon protests the presence of Jedi Master Dooku at this meeting, since it has come to our attention that he is Serenian by birth."
Sereno's arrogant Count Vimax started to respond when Dooku cut him off, addressing himself to the litigator.
"If you had investigated further, you would also know that I renounced all ties to my family and Serrano on being accepted into the Jedi Order."
He turned his penetrating gaze on Selenon's ambassador.
"I assure you that I will be as impartial as any one of you."
Selenon's ambassador, a large, bumptious human, cleared his throat in a meaningful way.
"Jedi Master Dooku's reputation for even-handedness precedes him. We trust that he will be as fair in this matter as he is known to have been elsewhere." "With that issue behind us," Vimek said, "I call for an official start to these proceedings."
The issue at hand involved the planned construction of an Aqualish manufactured hyperwave repeater in Selenon space that would expand the reach of the HoloNet well into the corporate sector, a vast region of the Tingle Arm that had become an economic playground for the banking clan and the corporate alliance, through lucrative deals brokered by Damask Holdings. In compensation for the fact that placement of the repeater would necessitate changes in hyperspace trade routes, Selenon had announced that ships entering Selenon space from the systems of the Upper Hydean would be required to pay substantial transit taxes. Plagueis had limited interest in the debate. Secretly, he hoped that mediation would fail. Citing controversy, Damask Holdings could then withdraw and the project would collapse, leaving systems in the Tingle Arm fuming over having been victimized by a foolish squabble between two wealthy Republic worlds. After 4 hours of pointless back and forth, Plagueis began to feel like the victimized one. When Count Vimek finally called a break in the proceedings, and many of the participants headed to the food tables, Plagueis found himself alone with Dooku, Sifo Dyas, and Qui-Gon Jinn, and drew the cloak of the profane over himself. "Bickering is becoming all too common," he remarked to no one in particular. "In the absence of resolution, it will be the outlying systems that will suffer most." Dooku nodded sagely.
"The hyperwave repeater should have been a Republic undertaking. The Senate erred in allowing the HoloNet to be privatized."
Qui-Gon Jinn's ears pricked up, and he glanced at Plagueis.
"Discontent in the outer systems is in keeping with the aims of Damask Holdings, is it not, Magister?"
"On the contrary," Plagueis replied in a composed voice.
"We advocate for the interests of neglected worlds when and wherever we can."
The tall Jedi wasn't persuaded to back off.
"By supporting the likes of the Trade Federation and other cartels."
"The Trade Federation has brought progress to many a backward world, Master Jinn,
through exploitation that leads ultimately to ruin."
Plagueis spread his hands.
"Progress often comes at a cost.
On occasion, a world will go through growth pangs as a result, but to call the end result ruination is overstating the case.
He studied Qui-Gon.
Surely the Jedi have had to ignore consequences of the same magnitude in enforcing the laws of the Republic.
Sifo Dyas's dark brows formed a V. A short, muscular man, he had a broad nose, prominent cheekbones, and lustrous black hair cinched in a high topknot. His hands were large and calloused, as if from physical labor. Concern shone in his brown eyes.
"It is a misconception that we serve only the Republic, Magister. Our order serves the greater good."
"As the order defines it," Plagueis said, only to wave the remark away. "But then you have the advantage of being able to act in concert with the Force, where the rest of us are left to grope in the dark for what is just and right. Damask Holdings tries, nonetheless, to take the long view."
"As do the Jedi," Qui-Gon said.
"But in several instances where we have had to resolve conflicts, it is your name that has surfaced." Plagueis shrugged. "The wealthy are held to higher standards than the poor."
Dooku thought about it.
"I blame the Senate for encouraging the galaxy to turn on credit."
Plagueis glanced from Dooku to Qui-Gon.
"I'm willing to concede Master Jin's point that the Munes have cornered the market on finance, if he is willing to concede that the Jedi have cornered the market on ethics."
Qui-Gon granted Plagueis a dignified bow.
"And so we find ourselves on different sides, Magister."
"Not necessarily. Perhaps we are after the same thing."
"Different paths to the same destination. It's a clever rationalization, but I refuse to accept it."
Qui-Gon placed his hands in the opposite sleeves of his robe.
"If you'll excuse me."
Dooku smiled lightly as the tall Jedi sauntered off.
"My former apprentice does not mince words."
"Frank talk is a rarity these days," Plagueis said. "The Senate could learn from beings like Qui-Gon Jinn."
Dooku made a glum face.
"The Senate listens only to itself. Endlessly and without purpose. If it and Supreme Chancellor Darus are going to perpetuate a climate where injustice can advance, then it will."
Sifo Dyas grew uneasy.
"The Rotunda is an arena even we don't enter," he said in a level voice, "except as spectators."
Plagueis could not restrain a smile.
"But you have, from time to time, been known to lobby,"
he continued before Sifo Dyas or Dooku could answer.
"It can be a circus. One thing is certain, however. The core is not holding. New leadership is needed."
"Darus will undoubtedly be elected to another term," Dooku said.
Plagueis pretended concern.
"Is there no one who can defeat him, Master Dooku?"
"Frix, possibly. Kalpana, eventually. At present, he isn't strong enough to overcome the special interest lobbies."
Sifo Dyas's unease increased.
"We are sworn not to take an active role in any case."
"Kalpana would certainly set a different tone," Plagueis said. "But perhaps an equally risky one. His stance against piratism, smuggling, even slavery is well known. Unfortunately, many of the outer systems survive only because of such practices."
"Then those worlds will have to find alternative means," Sifo Dyas said.
Plagueis turned to him.
"Without assistance from the Republic, it begins to sound to me as if the Jedi will have their work cut out for them."
Sifo Dyas compressed his lips.
"The Judicials and the Jedi will maintain peace."
"There's certainty in your voice," Plagueis said. "But let me pose a question. If discontent spreads and intersystem conflict breaks out, if member worlds threaten secession, as Serrano threatened in times past, would your loyalties not be divided?"
"The Republic will be preserved,"
Plagueis grinned.
Again that comforting confidence. But suppose the Republic's goals were not in keeping with the greater good. Suppose conflict grew to become actual schism. The two Jedi traded looks.
In the absence of armies, there can be no war, Dooku said. Are the Jedi not an army? Or at least capable of becoming one should the need arise?
We were an army at one time, but our enemies were vanquished, Sifo Dyas said with deliberate vagueness. No matter the extent of the conflict, we would attempt to forge a peace, and without becoming the ruling body you seem to fear.
Plagueis didn't reply immediately. Sifo Dyas was proving to be even more interesting than Dooku, though in a different way. Only a misguided sense of loyalty to the Jedi Order kept him from giving voice to the real extent of his apprehensions.
And yet you say, forge a peace. That has the ring of semantics to it, Master Sifo Dyas. But for the sake of argument, what if the disaffected systems raised an army? Wouldn't the Jedi be obligated to serve and protect the Republic?
Sifo Dyas forced an exhale.
From where would these hypothetical armies arise? The outlying systems lack the resources.
Realizing his error, he trailed off. Plagueis waited a moment, his satisfaction concealed.
I didn't mean to suggest that the Republic is purposely depriving the outlying systems of the right to self-determination. I'm merely speculating because I do see a growing threat.
Dooku regarded him.
You are not alone in seeing it, Magister.
Then one final question, if I may. If attacked, would you counterattack?
The Republic has pledged to remain demilitarized, Dooku said. It would militarize only in the instance of a perceived threat.
Once more, you've reframed your initial question, Magister Damask,
Sifo Dyas interrupted, a new fire in his eyes.
You're hypothesizing an attack on the Jedi Order itself.
I suppose I am, Plagueis said self-deprecatingly. I suppose I was thinking of the recent assassination of Senator Vidar Kim. A Jedi was involved, if I'm not mistaken.
That matter is being looked into, Sifo Dyas said in a controlled voice. There's no evidence to suggest that the Jedi in question was targeted.
The silence that followed was broken by the voice of Jocasta Nu, who was summoning the Jedi to the far side of the conference room. Plagueis studied Sifo Dyas peripherally. While Nu and the others conferred, he thought back to the conversation he'd had with Sidious on Sojourn.
We will have to exploit their self-righteousness and blind obedience to the Republic, Sidious had said at one point. The Jedi must be made to appear the enemies of peace and justice, rather than the guardians.
Mulling it over anew, Plagueis began to wonder whether he had taken the wrong approach on Kamino. Perhaps, he thought, it would be better to have the Kaminoans create an army capable of fighting alongside the Jedi, rather than against them. Sifo Dyas was the first to return to Plagueis' corner of the room, as if eager to continue the conversation.
Lest you're thinking of investing in military enterprises, Magister, I can assure you that the Republic will not reverse its stance on demilitarization.
His words were forceful but lacked certainty.
The Rusan reformations will not be repealed.
Plagueis showed the palms of his hands.
And I can assure you, Master Jedi, that my questions were in no means motivated by thoughts of profit. I, don't wish to see the Republic caught off guard. For now, I'll place my faith in the Jedi, and in the belief that an army could be raised if necessary.
Sifo Dyas's gaze faltered.
Out of thin air? Unlikely, Magister.
Grown, then.
Manufactured, you mean?
No, I was being literal, Plagueis said. But I know of only one group that might be up to the task. The group who grew laborers to work the mines of Subterral.
Puzzlement wrinkled Sifo Dyas's face. I'm not familiar with Sub-Terra.
Plagueis was about to mention Kamino when he spied Jocasta Nu approaching, and a feeling from deep in the dark side rose up inside him, strangling his voice box, as if refusing to let the word escape.
I apologize, Master Jedi, he said when he could. The name of the group was on the tip of my tongue, but I seem to have swallowed it.
Chapter 18. Artful Dodging. Palpatine had been on Coruscant for just over 2 standard months when the Senate convened to vote on whether or not to seat Felucia, Makana, and a half a dozen other planets considered by many to be client worlds of the Trade Federation. In the hope of generating public interest, Coruscant Climate Control had promised to provide perfect weather over the government district. Clouds had been swept aside, and orbital mirrors had been positioned to provide maximum daylight. Maintenance droids had refreshed the paving stones of Senate Plaza and polished the 30-meter-tall statues that lined the avenue of the Corps Founders. Police had cordoned off large areas of the district between levels 55 and 106 and deployed sniper units, squads of bomb detector automata, and 3 times the usual number of security hovercams. Reporters, documentarians, freelance journalists, and op-ed columnists were out in force, calling in favors in an effort to be as close to the action as possible. Limousine services were working overtime, and taxis were nearly impossible to find, which left aides and assistants to fend for themselves. Arriving on foot or by maglev, ensembles freshly laundered, headpieces blocked, fur coiffed, boots buffed. Even the Jedi Knights and Padawans stationed throughout the plaza as a show of force appeared to be sporting their cleanest robes and tunics. Analysts were touting the vote as landmark, though it had been an admittedly slow newsweek on Coruscant. More to the point, a vast majority of the capital's residents couldn't have cared less about the outcome, since most only knew of the Trade Federation through self-serving advertisements that streamed on the holonet. Local gossip was always more interesting than politics in any case. For weeks, however, opponents and supporters of the amendments that would revise the rules regarding member status in the Republic had been giving voice to their arguments in the Great Rotunda, often vociferously enough to shake their repulsor lift platforms, jabbing fingers and other appendages in the air for emphasis or accusation, in defiance of calls by the Vice-Chancellor for order and decorum. Standing with Sate Pestage and Kinman Doriana beneath the abstract statue of Corps founder Tyler Sapius Praji, Palpatine felt one step closer to his destined place, even if the scene in the plaza struck him as more Vanity Fair than senatorial assembly. Like many of the others, he had been out half the night drinking and dining with lobbyists eager to win his favor. At Tapcaf's cantinas, restaurants, and nightclubs throughout the entertainment districts, credits had flowed freely. Whispered bribes had been proffered, promises made, deals struck. Now some of the players he had encountered during the long evening were shuffling, bleary-eyed, through the gaping entrances of the umbrella-shaped Senate building. Senators and their top aides, commissioners of the investment sector and securities exchange, members of the Trade Federation delegation, and the board of the Intergalactic Banking Clan. Elsewhere on the broad avenue, at key intersections, taxi stops, and maglev exits, stood groups of Jedi, a few with the hilts of their lightsabers conspicuously visible. For Palpatine, the sight of so many of them in one place was at once exhilarating and sobering. Though thoroughly cloaked in the everyday, he could feel their collective pride trickle into him through the Force. Only the baseness of Coruscant's populace, the almost sheer absence of anything natural, kept the world from being as strong in the light as Korriban was in the dark. While he accepted that he and Plagueis were more than equal to the most powerful of the Jedi Order, he understood that they were no match for their combined strength, the Sith imperative notwithstanding.
the Jedi would fall only with the full collaboration of the dark side. That was, only when the dark side of the Force was ready and willing to conspire in their downfall. His musings were interrupted by a sudden gust of wind, whipped up by a luxurious landspeeder that was alighting in the center of the avenue, preceded by a vanguard of ceremonial guards wearing floor-length blue robes. Supreme Chancellor Darris emerged, waving to the crowd and for the hovercams that rushed in to immortalize his every expression. Palpatine studied him as the guards began to maneuver him through the throng, a train of hand-picked journalists following dutifully in his wake. The easy way he carried himself, the way he made a point to stop and greet some while ignoring others, the way he laughed on cue. He recalled the two coronations he and his father had attended in Theed, and could remember as if yesterday the envy that had wafted from Kosinga like sour sweat. How cravenly his inept father had desired to wield such power. And would that Kosinga could see his son now, standing so close to the center, surveying the Senate as Kosinga might have the Palpatine lands in the Lake Country, thinking, "Everything that my gaze falls on will be mine. These buildings, these monads, these statues I will have slagged, this airspace whose use I will restrict to the powerful, that penthouse in 500 Republica, this Senate." Again his musings were interrupted, this time by the Grand Protectorate Senator Pak's team, who was waddling briskly toward him, followed closely by the senators from Liana, Ariadu, and Sullust.
"Are you ready to make history, Senator?" Team said, his eye stalks quivering in excitement. "Rather than be a casualty of it," Palpatine told him. The Grand grunted in amusement. "Well said, young sir. Needless to say, many are counting on you." "Better many than all, because we cannot please everyone." Team grew serious. "Perhaps not. But we can strike a blow for utilitarianism. The greatest good for the greatest number."
Palpatine smiled in the way he had seen Darris smile.
"And strike a blow we shall, Senator." "Good, good," Team chortled. "Then we'll see you inside, where the galaxy's business is done."
Pestage snorted a laugh as Team was moving away.
"The greatest good for the greatest grand."
It was true. Team harbored no ill toward the Trade Federation. He merely wanted to see Naboo blunder, Hego Damask cut down to size, and Malastare returned to its quondam grandeur. The contingent of senators had scarcely left when Palpatine heard his name called. Turning, he saw Ranha Kim in the company of two older human Jedi. Quietly, he pulled his powers deeper into himself and adopted a mask of cordiality.
"Jedi Ranha," he said, inclining his head in greeting.
The black-haired Jedi returned the nod.
"Senator Palpatine, may I introduce Masters Dooku and Sifo Dyas?"
Palpatine was familiar with the former, but only by reputation.
"A great honor, Masters."
Dooku appraised him openly, then arched an eyebrow.
"Excuse me for staring, Senator, but Ranha's descriptions of you led me to expect someone older."
"I disguise myself well, Master Dooku. My age, that is."
"Either way," Sifo Dyas remarked, "a talent required by your position."
"An ignoble truth, Master Sifo Dyas, but we strive to remain faithful to our conscience."
Dooku smiled with purpose.
"Hold tight to that, Senator Palpatine. Coruscant will surely test your resolve."
Ranha Kim had his mouth open to speak when another familiar voice rang out.
"I didn't realize that you were acquainted."
Over Dooku's shoulder, Palpatine saw in surprise that Hego Damask, Lash Hill, and two other black-robed munes were threading their way toward him. That he hadn't sensed his master spoke to Plagueis's power to completely conceal himself, even from a fellow Sith.
"Magister Damask,"
Dooku and Sifo Dyas said simultaneously, turning to greet him.
Damask looked at Palpatine. Recently, on Sereno, in fact, Masters Dooku, Sifo-Dyas, and I engaged in a spirited discussion about the current state of the galaxy and our hopes for the future.
Sereno, Palpatine said, more to himself and mildly confounded.
Damask hadn't said anything about Jedi attending the meeting there, so what message was he sending now?
Glancing at the trio of Jedi, he thought back to his master's remark that even Jedi could be turned to the dark. Had the near-bungled assassination of Vidar Kim persuaded Plagueis to entice and recruit a Jedi to serve as his apprentice?
Ranha just introduced us to the Senator, Sifo-Dyas was explaining.
Dooku's eyes moved from Damask to Palpatine and back again.
May I inquire how it is that you and the Senator know each other?
Damask motioned to Palpatine.
Senator Palpatine and Damask Holding share a dream for Naboo.
He gestured inclusively to Hill and the other Munes.
Palpatine was one of the few who early on saw the wisdom of ushering in a new era for his homeworld.
Palpatine sensed scrutiny from someone outside the circle the ten of them had formed. Just short of the Senate building's great door, Pak's team had stopped and was gazing at Palpatine, his eye stalks extended. And Palpatine could scarcely blame him, since even he had been caught off guard by Plagueis' eagerness to acknowledge him in public.
How does it feel to have realized your wish for your homeworld? Dooku said.
Palpatine came back to himself.
One can't very well stand in the way of destiny.
Again, Dooku glanced from Palpatine to Damask.
The will of the Force begets uncommon fellowships.
Chimes sounded, announcing that the session was beginning, and everyone began to file through the doors into the massive structure, going their separate ways from the atrium, some to spectators' boxes or media areas, others, like Palpatine, Sate, and Kinmon, to turbolifts that accessed Naboo's station in the Senate's middle tier, one of 1,000 identical docking stations in the rotunda, outfitted with a detachable repulsor lift platform and a suite of private offices. Central to the artificially lighted space was an elegant tower emblazoned with the seal of the Republic, at the summit of which rested the Supreme Chancellor's podium. Doris, the Vice-Chancellor, and the administrative aide were already present, and after brief introductory remarks by the Supreme Chancellor, the Vice-Chancellor called the matter to a vote. A few senators spoke, but most simply cast their votes, a tally of which was relayed to monitor screens at each station and projected overhead along the inner curve of the dome. By the time the Vice-Chancellor recognized the Chommel sector, the vote was tied. Though Palpatine's vote would break the stalemate, several systems had yet to weigh in. Detached from the docking station, the platform carried Palpatine out over the lower tiers and deep into the kilometers-wide rotunda. A hush fell over a portion of the Senate, and he inhaled the moment deep into himself. Still, the platform continued to move toward the podium, as if even the Supreme Chancellor wanted a closer look at him, and it pleased him to know that his reputation had spread that far. Then Palpatine spoke to them.
The Trade Federation came to Naboo some 10 years ago. It didn't arrive by force, but by invitation, after a vast reservoir of plasma was discovered beneath Naboo's lush mantle, vast enough to supply clean energy to hundreds of disadvantaged worlds along the Hydean Way, and at the same time, introduce Naboo to the galactic community. Following months of reasoned debate, our newly elected monarch decided that Naboo should share its resources with the galaxy. Agreements were struck between Naboo and the Trade Federation, along with several construction conglomerates. Mining was begun, processing plants were constructed, and spaceports were enlarged to accommodate the fleet of shuttles needed to ferry the plasma to cargo ships parked in orbit. 3 years later, plasma was flowing out into the galaxy and wealth was flowing into Naboo and the worlds of the Chommel Sector
and an era of unprecedented prosperity had begun. That prosperity came with hidden costs, but Naboo was willing to absorb them, primarily for the sake of those beings who were benefiting from what nature had bequeathed to our small world.
He paused and turned slightly in the direction of the Trade Federation's platform.
The Trade Federation has been accused of price-fixing, exploitation, and monopolistic practices, but those matters are not at issue today. Today, the Republic is being asked to widen its embrace to include several planets in the outlying systems many consider to be client worlds of the cartel. Many of you are concerned that seating these worlds will tip the balance of power by giving the Trade Federation and its corporate allies too strong a voice in the Senate. But was this matter not already settled when the courts of justice ruled that the Trade Federation should be treated as if it were a world? That decision opened the door to entities like the Commerce Guild, the Techno Union, and the Corporate Alliance, all of which enjoy their separate platforms in this hall. So the issue of legality is not up for debate. Instead, we must set ourselves to the task of deciding if the Trade Federation has become too aggressive in its pursuit of a louder voice.
Again he paused, this time to allow individual debates to come and go.
Not 3 standard months ago,
he said at last,
the Chamul Sector's senator of long standing was assassinated here on Coruscant. Senator Kim was known to many of you as an honest being, concerned about the growing influence of the cartels and the potential for a shift in power in the Senate. His tragic death provoked allegations and prompted investigations, and yet no progress has been made in determining the motive for his murder or identifying the agents behind it. This, despite inquiries by judicials, the Senate Investigatory Committee, even the Jedi Order. As a consequence of, and yes, in protest against the manner in which the investigation into Senator Kim's death has been handled, I am instructed by my regent, King Bon Tapelo, to announce that Naboo and the Chamul Sector worlds are abstaining from the vote.
The hush that had fallen over a select section of the Senate spread to include the entire rotunda. Then the outburst that erupted, both damning and championing, was so clamorous and prolonged that the Vice Chancellor ultimately curtailed his attempts to restore order and let chaos reign. Chapter 19. The Trials. In the aftermath of the Trade Federation victory in the Senate, Felucia, Mercana, and other former client worlds became members of the Republic, unswerving in their allegiance to the needs of the Trade Federation. While Pax Team and a handful of similarly disappointed senators shunned Palpatine, accusing him and Naboo of having been bought by the cartel, most of the Senate dismissed the matter with a shrug. Palpatine was new to the game, and in fact was merely expressing the wishes of King Tapelo. More important, the seating of new worlds meant new revenue and additional opportunities for graft. Ranha Kim thanked Palpatine personally for not mentioning him in his address to the Senate. Moved by Palpatine's appeal, Supreme Chancellor Darras sent a personal message stating that he was instructing the Judiciary Committee to use its wide-ranging powers to unravel the Kim assassination. Plagueis was pleased by the results, since it was only a matter of time before the newly seated worlds would find themselves caught between the Republic on the one hand and the Trade Federation on the other. Taxed by the former, exploited by the latter, the perfect recipe for resentment. The two Sith did not meet in person, but Plagueis notified his apprentice that he and the other Munes would be remaining on Coruscant for the foreseeable future, primarily to attend the induction of Larsh Hill into the Arcane Order of the Canted Circle, many of whose members were regulars at the gatherings on Sojourn. For Darth Sidious, the weeks following the vote were a return to business as usual. With the Senate still in session, he spent most of his days in the Rotunda and most of his nights continuing to explore Coruscant, often in the company of Pestage and Doriana. In secret, he continued his Sith training, accepting the absence of actual guidance from his master as a sign that he was meant to stretch out on his own. And so he did, delving into many of the ancient texts Plagueis dismissed as worthless, including treatises on Sith sorcery and holocron construction. Toward the end of the third week, he was contacted by a lobbyist for an energy consortium known as Silvestri Trace Power. In several comlink exchanges, the lobbyist, a Sulliston, made it clear that Senator Palpatine stood to profit greatly by advocating for STP in the Senate, and suggested a meeting to discuss terms. Sidious probably wasn't supposed to dig too deeply into the origins of STP, or succeed in discovering ways around the roadblocks the consortium had constructed to thwart just such investigations, but he did, and was intrigued to learn that STP had once been a shell company created by Zillow Fuel Resources, which was based on Malastare. Suspecting an attempt at entrapment, Sidious agreed to a daytime meeting, the location of which served only to further arouse his suspicions. Unlike the upper-tier restaurants patronized by the political crowd, the Shimmer Silk was in a low-tier district known colloquially as Patu, which to most beings stood for the periphery of the Uscrew, but to the better informed meant the peril of the Uscrew. A slowly gentrifying area accessed by the deep-core maglev line that had once been the haunt of turf gangs, serial killers, molesters, thieves, and other bottom feeders on a world whose bottom was uncommonly deep. With residents preying mainly on one another, the police saw little reason to patrol, and even security cams were scarce as they were frequently stolen and disassembled for parts. Still, the risk of mayhem or murder appealed to the Rotunda crowd, and it wasn't unusual to encounter a senator or an aide slumming in the Patu, mingling with shady beings, indulging in proscribed substances, flirting with danger. Sidious considered bringing Pestage and Doriana along, but ultimately rejected the idea. In the absence of undergoing any formal training with Plagueis, he was eager to see what he could do on his own. Cramped and rattled by the frequent passage of nearby maglev trains, the Shimmer Silk catered to what looked like a local crowd. Dressed down for the meeting, as was Sidious, the Sulliston lobbyist was waiting at a corner table with his back to a wall adorned with cheap holo images. Only six other tables were occupied, non-human couples in the main, and catered to by three clumsy human waiters and a dud bartender. Instrumental Jats music, barely audible, wafted through air in sore need of recycling. Sidious adopted a look of wide-eyed innocence as he sat down opposite the Sulliston. They began to talk in a general way about current events and Senate business, before the lobbyists steered the conversation toward STP's need for Senate approval to expand its operations along the Rimmer trade route. Drinks and appetizers were ordered and reordered, and before too long, Palpatine's interest began to wane.
"I think you may have overvalued my worth to STP," he said at last. "I'm nothing more than the voice of Naboo's regent."
The Sulliston waved his small hand in a gesture of dismissal.
"And I think you undervalue yourself. Your short speech to the Senate put you on the map, Senator. The beings are talking about you. STP believes that you can be of great service."
"And to myself, you say?"
"Naturally,"
the Sulliston started, but Sidious interrupted him.
"In fact, you're not here to recruit me."
Motioning negligently, he repeated.
"You're not here to recruit me."
The Sulliston blinked in confusion.
In fact, I'm not really here to recruit you."
"Then why are we here?"
"I don't know why we're here. I was instructed to meet with you."
Instructed by whom? Sidious decided not to press him too hard. You were saying... Again, the Celestine blinked.
I was saying... Just what was I saying?
They both laughed and sipped at their drinks. At the same time, Sidious used the Force to shift the apron of one of the waiters just enough to reveal the grip of a holdout blaster the man was wearing at his waist. Lifting his glass for another swallow, he did the same to another of the waiters, whose apron concealed an identical weapon. Both had been manufactured by Blastech, but not for common consumption. The E-Series 1-9, the aptly named Swift Kick, was available only to elite members of Sante Security, headquartered on Liana.
I had better slow down,
he said with purposeful awkwardness.
I believe I'm becoming a bit lightheaded.
The Celestine's demeanor changed, though almost imperceptibly.
You just need some more food.
He slid a menu across the table.
Choose whatever you wish. Cost is no issue.
He stood.
If you'll excuse me for a moment, we'll order as soon as I return.
Sidious noted that the Celestine wasn't the only one getting to his feet. Under low-voiced orders from the waiters, patrons were calling for their checks and exiting. In moments, he would be the Shimmersilk's sole customer. As he swung slightly in his chair to stare into the corner of the room, a scenario began to emerge in his imaginings. The Celestine, STP's link to Malastare, Sante security agents, even the Doug bartender. Their issues were not with him, but with Damask Holdings. He wasn't being set up for an eventual allegation of corruption. A far more sinister deception was unfolding, and his interest was immediately renewed. His first thought was that they had attempted to drug him. His investigations into Sith sorcery had taught him how to nullify the effects of many common poisons and venoms, a practice he had performed routinely before he'd even seated himself at the table. Perhaps, then, they were waiting for him to slump forward and lapse into unconsciousness or froth at the mouth and be shaken by spasms. Just when he was thinking that it was his acting ability that was going to be put to the test, two of the waiters converged on him, now showing their discreet but powerful weapons.
"Someone wants a word with you, Senator,"
the taller of the pair said.
"Here,"
Sidious said in apparent confusion. The other one motioned to a door.
"Through there!"
Sidious masked his smile. The Shimmersilk had a back room. He stood clumsily, leaning deliberately toward one of the security men, gauging his body temperature, heart rate, and respiration.
"I'm slightly intoxicated. I may have to count on you for support."
The man made a sound of exasperation, but allowed Sidious to place one arm on his shoulder.
"How effortless it would be,"
he thought, as the dark began to rise in him, searing and hungry, yearning to assume control of his body and unleash itself.
"To break the necks of both of them, to tear their beating hearts from their chests, to hurl and plaster them against the walls, to bring the entire sour-smelling place down on their heads."
But he didn't. He needed to meet his abductor. He needed to learn the names of all those responsible. He needed to prove to his master that he was adroit and capable, a true Sith Lord. The back room had a second door that opened into a dark corridor leading to an ancient turbolift. Shoved forward by the guards, Sidious calculated the distance they had come from the Shimmersilk to the turbolift. He fell silent as they began to rise, and devoted his attention to calculating the rate of climb. He estimated that they had risen 50 levels when the turbolift came to a halt, depositing them in a corridor as aged as the first, though wider, tiled, and illuminated by wall sconces. Perhaps a maintenance corridor for the monads above, though still far below what would constitute the deepest of the sub-basements. The Sante security men guided him north across a stretch of stained permacrete floor to an intersection where a four-being speeder was idling, a heavily armed Rodian seated at the controls.
"This one isn't Sante,"
Sidious told himself. A freelance mercenary or assassin. Shoved roughly onto the speeder's rear bench seat, he was reminded not to do anything foolish. Restraining an impulse to reveal that they already had, he continued to play the intimidated abductee, cowering in the seat, hands interlocked in his lap, avoiding eye contact. The speeder traveled east at a moderate speed until the first intersection, then turned in the direction of the government district and resumed the same speed for a longer duration. Sidious reckoned that they were 20 or so tiers beneath the outlying buildings of the Senate when the speeder swung west into an even broader corridor toward a district known as the Flats, or the Works, a kind of industrial plain situated well below the governmental plateau, overlooked to the far north by the Jedi Temple and the horizontal landing fields of Pius Dia Spaceport, and to the south by the reza blocks and commercial towers of the Phobosi District, where Plagueis was attending Lash Hill's induction into the Order of the Canted Circle. The Rodian speeder pilot delivered them to an antigrav turbolift car. While pretending to tremble in fear, Sidious had come to an additional conclusion. The fact that his abductors had gone to a lot of trouble to keep him out of public view meant that the plan called for him to be held for ransom or executed clandestinely rather than publicly. The elevator carried them to a mid-level docking area of an abandoned factory, where several more guards were waiting. Oblique, particulate-suffused daylight streamed through massive windows yet to be smashed by the gangs that ruled the works, falling on items that had been deemed worthless when the factory's owners had abandoned Coruscant for less costly worlds in the mid or outer rim. Sidious's human handlers forced him to sit atop the boxy body of an overturned power droid. A portable holoprojector was moved into position in front of him, and a transmission grid placed under his feet. One of the Santhe guards spent a moment activating the projector, then stepped aside as a faintly blue, life-sized image of Grand Protectorate Senator Pack's team took shape above. Team was dressed in a richly brocaded robe and a shimmer silk tunic banded by a broad cummerbund. The stable and sharply detailed quality of the image suggested that its source was Coruscant, or a nearby core world, rather than Malastair.
We apologize for not having provided a seat more suited to your station, Senator. No doubt the head of House Palpatine is accustomed to more comfortable surroundings.
Sidious rejected outrage and intimidation for rankled curiosity.
Is this the point where I'm expected to ask why I've been abducted?
Team's eye stalks lengthened.
You're not the least bit interested.
I assume that this has something to do with Naboo's abstention in the vote.
That's certainly part of the reason. You should have voted as your predecessor would have, Senator.
Those were not my instructions.
Oh, I'm certain of that much.
Sidious folded his arms across his chest.
And the rest of it?
Team rubbed his six-fingered hands together in eagerness.
This has less to do with you than with the beings you serve. In a way, it's simply your bad luck that you find yourself in the middle.
I don't believe in bad luck, Senator, but I take your point to mean that my abduction is an act of retribution. And as such, you demonstrate that the Grand Protectorate is willing to employ the same tactics used by those who ordered the assassination of Vidar Kim.
Team leaned toward the cam that was transmitting his image and allowed anger to contort his features.
You say that as if it's still a mystery, when we both know that the murder wasn't ordered by the Trade Federation, but by your Mune master, by Higo Damask.
Sidious's expression didn't change.
He is hardly my master, Senator. In fact, I scarcely know him.
He greeted you in front of the Senate building like a close friend.
He was extending his greeting to two Jedi masters I happened to be standing with.
Team's right forefinger jabbed the air.
Don't delude yourself into thinking that you can save yourself by lying. You and Damask have known each other for more than 10 years, ever since you were instrumental in helping him guarantee the election of Bontapolo.
Sidious gestured casually. An old rumor that has no basis in fact, begun and perpetuated.